Hello, everybody. I'm Sarah Eisen. I'm a host at CNBC. I'm thrilled to be back here at the IMF for the IMF World Bank meetings and to moderate this incredible IMF World Bank panel on the future of finance on crypto. And what I have here is hot off the press, the finance and development issue of September. Cover story, stablecoins and the future of finance. I think it's also very telling that we are here in this blockbuster headline panel with so many folks here.
The annual meetings aren't only where central bankers and policymakers come together to talk about their world. Sometimes it's where they're introduced to the innovators who are changing their world in a big way.
The compounding technology of blockchain operating systems, of stablecoin money, of AI, agentic infrastructure, it's on a curve that is, I think, going to lead to a world that looks radically different. Monetary sovereignty will be challenged. I think we just have to face that fact. There will be fewer currencies. I think we have to face that fact. And we're gonna have intermediation and integration economically with velocity that we've never seen before. And these are wonderful problems.
Jeremy Allaire is the founder of Circle, the issuer of one of the world's largest stablecoins. And in this panel, he shares the stage with the managing director of the IMF, the president of the World Bank, the head of JP Morgan's Global Payments, and the director of Singapore's Monetary Authority.
Technological progress is happening so rapidly. And my own view, for example, is that in you know 5 years' time, like the concept of a cross-border payment is going to sound like a cross-border email. Like, when is the last time you sent a cross-border email? It doesn't even make sense. When all of these people...
I caught up with Jeremy Allaire's colleague at Circle shortly after that panel to talk about their vision of the future of finance.
I'm Dante Disparte. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer and Head of Global Policy at Circle.
Great. Thank you so much, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
All right. So what does it take to launch a stablecoin?
Well, it is a very, very, very good question. In fact, it's your cover story of finance and development, and it's been a main stage conversation here at the fall meetings for the IMF and the World Bank. What does it take to launch a stablecoin? I think one of the main points is trust, right? A stablecoin is meant to do to dollars what MP3s did to music, which is that you still own the music is still yours, but the fact that you've changed the technological form factor of money allows you to have more control. And what I like to call the four S's, how you send, spend, save, and secure money, can now be delivered and rendered anywhere in the world on any basic internet-connected device. So the core component of a stablecoin is trust. Now we also have a whole superstructure of regulation and rules that have made this innovation a really critical part of extending the reach of the global economy and extending the reach of the financial system.
Okay, so you mentioned MP3 files. There were problems with MP3 files when they came. People were looking for regulations. There was Napster, if you remember, back in the MP3 days. I don't want to go too far back. But there are issues with the stablecoin, similar issues, I would say, maybe, in terms of regulation these days. What kind of hurdles are you looking at?
Indeed. And if I didn't realize the analogy to music would go as far as we have taken it so far, but it is a useful one to think of, in that in the absence of rules for this sector, we have had over the last 7 years many teachable lessons in what I like to call stable and name only coins. Pretty famously here in Washington, D.C., there was a big blow up a few years back of a so-called stable coin that entered circulation into the U.S. market, and it couldn't deliver the bill of goods, right? And so the product should deliver as it is advertised and as it is named. And so what we're finding around the world, however, is that by today's standards, both under a new law that has been passed in the United States called the Genius Act, and under a very comprehensive law that the Europeans passed called the Markets and Crypto Assets Framework, by those two standards alone, if a stablecoin enters circulation and is not regulated, it's because the issuer chose to avoid the rules. Okay. But our view is this is a race to the top innovation right now. And we're very heartened, frankly, by the level of interest, both from the public sector, but obviously private sector actors and others, in using this innovation to advance really critical and pretty stubborn global issues around systemic levels of underbanking and debanking, a lack of access to the global financial system for billions of people. We now have an innovation that could rethink what does it mean to deliver financial access at scale. And so therein, in my view, lies the opportunity versus the risk.
And so what about growth? I mean, cryptocurrencies have been growing exponentially in a very short period of time. What does it look like in the world of stablecoins?
Sure. I mean, well, today, stablecoins are nearly $300 billion in total circulation. Yeah. The vast majority of the circulation of stablecoins references the U.S. dollar, albeit to different degrees, as this new law comes into force. In our case, Circle is the issuer of two primary stablecoins. One is a dollar-backed stablecoin known as USDC, which is over $76 billion in total circulation. And we have a euro-denominated stablecoin, which is the largest euro stablecoin in the world, at around 226 million euros in circulation. Now, the premise here is you now have a form of money that can, again, back to the earlier point about reaching people at a much lower cost, but that can be rendered at scale. And so here we're seeing trillions of dollars of economic activity is supported by this new innovation. And we overcome one of the payments world's most insidious problems, which is the walled garden problem. Inside the walled garden, you have access to fast, cheap, low-cost payments. But outside of the walled garden, you run into an interoperability problem that would be analogous to Gmail not being able to send an email to Hotmail or to Yahoo because the systems don't speak to each other. That is probably the best analogy I could make for our financial rails and our pipes. And so stablecoins are breakthroughs in payment because they allow that payment activity to reach anyone, anywhere, again, for little more than a low-cost internet-connected device.
So the difference, if I understand this correctly, between a cryptocurrency or your usual cryptocurrency that we hear talk about a lot, like Bitcoin, for example, the stable coin is a backed digital asset. So if I were to go off and buy 10 of your USDC stable coins, where does that $10 reside?
That's a great question. And so, yes, a stable coin by today's regulatory standards, think of it simplistically as an upgrade on electronic money. We have had around the world in every major jurisdiction in the world clear rules on payments activity and electronic money activity. And so stablecoins are basically electronic money 2.0, a form of electronic money that should be treated with the legal certainty that you and I might enjoy of our bank account balances, but with even greater restrictions on those bank account balances. And I'll tell you why. A stablecoin entitles the holder to the right of redemption at par, even in the issuer's bankruptcy. That's been our operating model from the beginning, and it is now the legal basis for this innovation. And so for every USDC in circulation, it corresponds to cash and short-dated U.S. treasuries of 90 days or less in the banking system. Now, the banking system is an important partner. Contrary to the popular narrative that the emergence of crypto would make banks irrelevant and Wall Street irrelevant, what you're actually finding is that this is an innovation that could be built on the pillars of the underlying economy and the pillars of trust in that economy, including central banks, as opposed to competing with them, in part because without access to the banking system, you might find that a stablecoin looks more like a monetary airline mile than it does a form of digital money that was convertible and usable in the real economy.
Right. So if we're talking essentially about digital dollars, in this case, the USDC, and you mentioned the garden wall, which is a problem for the dollar as well, when we're doing cross-border currency transactions, how do you overcome that issue on the stablecoin platform?
Totally. Well, herein genuinely is the real breakthrough, which is that the stablecoin itself is a payments innovation unlike anything we have seen thus far. And the best way to describe it is if you think of all of the world's very mature payment systems and payment networks, at their core, they're primarily messaging platforms. Even large networks like SWIFT and many others that are relied upon globally for money movement of all currencies are first and foremost messaging platforms that send a message instruction of whose balance sheet to debit and credit. The stablecoin, however, merges the payment innovation, the settlement asset, and the message instruction. So now I get instant settlement. The second a transmission is made from my digital wallet to yours, the settlement is final. And that then introduces a whole host of opportunities. For example, the world's most important cash flow is peer-to-peer remittances. Yep. In a given year, prior to the pandemic and prior to recessions, this is a $700-800 billion global cash flow. It's typically recession-resistant, and it's one of the greatest forms of the diaspora populations can support their family and loved ones in their home countries. However, in those money movement corridors, for example, you still see this enormous tax, effectively, on that money flow. Yeah. And in some remittance corridors, it's upwards of 20%. And for some countries, just from a development agenda point of view, remittances correspond to 40-45% of their GDP in some cases. And so the ability to now deliver that money flow without the costly intermediary and without the death by a thousand cuts fee structures or the hurry up and wait proposition of getting the money to the sender and the receiver, you now have this breakthrough of stablecoins as a medium of exchange for those transactions. But how is that made possible? Is by virtue of the fact that the underlying blockchain infrastructure that powers stablecoins is open source. And so think of it like financial services shareware, that anyone anywhere has the same common ledger of these economic activities and these transactions, now can see where this money is moving. And that's part of what supports the payment breakthrough and what breaks through the walled garden problem that we have in payments.
So, in the traditional banking system, you mentioned remittances. It's costly and it's complicated and time consuming. And there are these intermediary banks that handle transactions. But there is also a whole bunch of rules and regulations to avoid money laundering and the financing of terrorism. Like, what kind of scrutiny is there on the transactions that happen on your platform to avoid these, bad players using your platform to get around these rules?
Totally. First of all, I couldn't agree more with the premise that financial inclusion, responsible financial innovation, and protecting the integrity of the financial system should never be seen as trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I think part of what we have been aspiring to demonstrate and some of the very first global rules to be harmonized in this market are exactly that, related to combating illicit finance and ensuring that bad actors do not get to co-opt good technologies or good innovations. Mm-hmm. So, the first order of business for countries listening to this discussion is to regulate the last mile of how stablecoins and any other digital asset might enter their economy, yeah, which is the mobile wallet infrastructure. These are known as virtual asset service providers or crypto asset service providers interchangeably, but that is effectively the last mile of how this value chain works at scale. Back in 2016, the Financial Action Task Force harmonized a set of rules around the notion that the travel rule should apply to digital asset transactions of any crypto asset, including stablecoins. And so that has leveled up financial crime compliance standards in the sector. There's also this other notion, which I like to think of as collective witness. One of the problems in combating illicit finance in the traditional banking system is that the banking system is opaque. The literal ledgers in which economic activity is transacted on are opaque and siloed to individual institutions. Blockchain-based financial services change that opacity, and most of this activity now lives in the light of day. And that's why law enforcement, national financial intelligence units, and others like the emergence of crypto assets and stablecoins as a medium not only of exchange, but also as a medium through which we can combat illicit money flows at world scale.
All right. So what is this? I've seen the term internet financial system.
Yes.
what does this mean for, the traditional monetary system that we're all familiar with? And, we're sitting in an institution that is very much focused on financial stability.
Yes.
What does this new internet financial system mean for financial stability, do you think? Are there risks there?
That's a very good question. And candidly, our CEO really coined this term of art of an internet financial system. And part of what animates us really focusing on this as a company is our mission statement. Okay. Our company's mission is to raise economic prosperity through the frictionless exchange of value. And we think of the exchange of value as something greater than payments and money itself. There's many other ways you could conceive of blockchains and late generation blockchains as an effective economic operating system that allow us to now do exactly what the Internet of Information did by democratizing information at true world scale, and with it creating a whole cottage set of industries that wouldn't have been possible pre the Internet. The next question is, well, then if you needed the Internet as a precondition for blockchain-based finance, then what then become the preconditions for modern economic activities and modern economic systems at world scale if you now have these novel activities that can be supported by this infrastructure? As the World Bank President Ajay Banga says, you know, people are everywhere, but opportunity is not. And one of the things I think we can do at scale today is ensure that opportunity can reach more people in more places than ever before. So the internet financial system for us is really all about how do we extend the reach at scale, and payments and money is the first of this wave of innovation that has taken off, but you can conceive of a whole host of other innovations over time.
So Circle isn't only an issuer of stablecoin. You've built a platform upon which these transactions can happen. Do you see yourselves as a utility to any extent? I mean, where other people can develop other ideas on your platform?
Yeah, well, 100%. Indeed, the one of the major distinctions between us and maybe peer financial institutions or peer technology companies is that 100% of what we've built from a technological point of view, including our core stablecoin USDC, is a builder-first innovation. It's all non-proprietary. It's open-source technology, and it allows people to not just receive a low-cost payment, but effectively, if they wanted to build a bank on the backs of these digital dollars and the related infrastructure.
So can you trade other stablecoins on your platform?
Yes, and this is where we're more than the issuer of digital money. We also have been developing over years now. USDC, for example, is available on more than 26 blockchains. That's a feature, not a bug, of this notion of constantly upgradable financial infrastructure that plugs into millions of people around the world, thousands of institutions, household name systemic financial institutions. And so we represent the safety and soundness of the dollar itself, but built on the pillars of the global economy that institutions like the IMF know and understand. We've also launched something called the Circle Payments Network, which the best way to describe it is a coordination and orchestration network that allows financial institutions to coordinate stablecoin money movement across borders and around the world. So that, again, instead of having this drag coefficient on the real economy of telling people to hurry up and wait for their money and their trade, that activity can now happen at speed. Because hurry up and wait is not a great property of moving money in the 21st century.
Hmm. Yeah. Not a good motto. So finally, I might end with, your colleague, the founder of Circle, was on a panel yesterday here at the IMF. And one of the people sitting beside him was the head of payments at JP Morgan, which is the biggest traditional payment system in the world. Should they be worried about platforms like your building?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. And so, you know, Umar Farouk is a dear friend. And while I would be tempted to make an analogy of Blockbuster Video at the dawn of Netflix, I won't go there, in part because what I see as the end state here is a world in which these types of innovations converge. And the convergence is the point. I think of what we've been doing at Circle since the company's founding, what our CEO said on the stage yesterday with the managing director and with a great panel, is all about completing unfinished work in the global financial system. If the banking system, including the very biggest and best endowed banks like JP Morgan, remained analog, then we would have problems with money movement itself and competition for money and how people have access to it. And so I think of this as additive to traditional institutions and traditional financial institutions. And over time, what we would love to see is convergence, including the notion of central bank digital currency projects, bank-issued projects, and non-bank-issued projects, to the extent they're all built on common standards and common principles, which is exactly what yesterday's great discussion was all about.
Well, Dante Disparte, Chief Strategy Officer and Head of Global Policy at Circle, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You
can watch the webcast of the Future of Finance seminar during the IMF World Bank annual meetings at imf.org. And check out Ishwar Prasad's article on what he calls the stablecoin paradox in the December issue of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.